Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Climate change is something many of us think about in the voting booth or when we make decisions about what we buy or consume. Increasingly, people are thinking about climate change at their houses of worship. Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Muslims, and other faith communities have issued statements about the need for climate action. Science and religion haven't always seen eye to eye. What's changed? Joining us to discuss the growing connection between faith communities and climate action, David McClinchy, Chief of External Affairs at the Woods Hole Research Center. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Reverend Bill Mebbin from St. Barnabas Episcopal Church in Falmouth, and Reverend Nell Fields from the Coit Congregational Church. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good to be with you, Mindy.
All right. We'd love to hear from you. Has your faith community influenced your views about climate change? Tell us how and why. 866-999-4626. What are some of the ways you're taking action to address climate change? Let us know. You can also email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. David, historically, scientists and faith leaders have found themselves on opposite sides of many issues, or at least not seeing eye to eye. Why is climate change different?
Well, you know, it's this overlap where you have the ecological and moral crisis coming together. And there's real power in the fact that there's two communities, which, as you said, don't usually align. On this issue, there is overlap and there is a common cause. And it's because it's so wide-reaching. The damages are going to be so extensive. They're going to impact us in so many ways that it just seeps throughout society. And that's recognized from a scientific perspective, but I think more importantly, from a moral perspective.
And you say going to, we're already seeing that. And maybe that's right. Kind of why people are opening up in their eyes. They're saying, all right, I'm already starting to see this, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The good news, the bad news is that the danger and the impacts are so imminent, but in some ways that's also something we can take advantage of. Yeah.
Now, you helped bring together a coalition of religious leaders and scientists to launch the Faith Science Alliance. Was it challenging to get one group or both to the table? Or what were some of the reasons for either group if they were reluctant?
Interestingly, faith leaders actually were more enthusiastic about joining the alliance. It was the scientists who we had to pull along. It was. I didn't expect that. But it was driven by the president of the Woods Hole Research Center, Phil Duffy, and Cardinal O'Malley from Boston. Those were the two kind of leaders from the two different communities. But we had faith leaders coming out of the woodwork, all stripes of religion. Our initial kickoff meeting had Baha'i ministers, imams, rabbis, all sorts of Christians. But the scientists were the more reluctant ones. And we ended up getting really, you know, a good cohort of scientists, but that was more work.
Right. So tell us more about the mission and activities of the Faith Science Alliance.
Well, the mission is to first and foremost get the issue out there and get it out there to audiences that wouldn't usually listen to that. There are people who listen to the Woods Hole Research Center. They listen to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, or MBL. And, you know, we have our audiences and we have people who put real value in our work. But there's audiences that we don't reach usually. But those audience maybe could be reached by Cardinal O'Malley or by their imam or by their rabbi. And so that's the initial value of this, you know, kind of messenger from their own communities. But the secondary part is simply the unusual nature of the coalition. I mean, as you said at the beginning, these aren't two groups that usually align. So we're hoping to get people's attention by saying, this is so important. You know, these two groups have come together.
Yeah. Reverend Mebbin, when and why did you start to take notice of climate change and begin incorporating this issue into your work as a faith leader?
Well, I have to say, I am slow to this. I am a bit ashamed and embarrassed to say that. You know, my head was sort of in the sand, had been in the sand. And I'm encouraged to hear David say that the response from faith leaders was enthusiastic, because I don't think I'm alone. I think a lot of faith leaders have just poo-pooed it and continue to believe that somehow God would take care of it, you know. So I'm late to the game, but I am trying to force feed myself as quickly and as much as I possibly can, and that's why I'm grateful to have people like David around who can teach me. So I'm trying to be that sponge, and also to place a clarion call to members of St. Barnabas, but all in congregations all across the Cape and the nation, to people to wake up and realize that the threat is imminent, and it is here, and it is at our doorstep. and we've got to start doing something about it.
Yeah. Now, what about you? Same question.
When I was in seminary in 2006, Reverend Jim Antall, who was our conference minister, met with all these new seminary students and said, if we don't deal with the climate crisis, you're not going to be in the business of ministering to people. You're going to be in the business of grief counseling. And I, to this day, when I think about that, it sends chills to me because it is absolutely true.
Mm. Both of your congregations are considering the declaration of a climate emergency, right? So how is climate emergency being defined? How are you defining that?
Well, I think, again, I would rely on David for that. I just know that when I see news reports of chunks of glaciers falling off into the seas and the seas rising, and I hear reports even here in this community that Surf Drive is going to be up in St. Barnabas' front yard in the next 50 years or so, if not sooner. That sounds like an emergency to me. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to happen. So that's why I'm and I was reluctant to call it an emergency. There is a member of our congregation, Betty Hecox Lee, who's the head of our outreach ministries, and she came to me a few months ago, and she said, you know, we need to start talking about this as an emergency. It's an emergency. Are you willing to say that it's an emergency? And I wasn't.
Mm. And now you are.
I was like, well, wait a minute. The emergency connotes certain things, right? The threat is imminent, devastation, et cetera, et cetera. And so I began to read, and she began to send me links to videos about it. And so the next time we met, I said, yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. Yeah. It is an emergency. Yeah.
So David, what is it, a declaration of a climate emergency? What does it mean?
Well, I think it's an acknowledgement of the scope and scale of the problems we're facing and we're going to face in coming decades. And it's not just these physical impacts that Reverend just described. It's the fact that when they hit, they're going to hit the poorest and most vulnerable communities the hardest. It's those communities that are least able to adapt, that are least able to relocate. Those are the ones that are going to take the brunt of these physical impacts, both here in the United States but around the world. Mm. And that, to me, is what makes this such an emergency, such a crisis, because the people oftentimes least responsible for causing the problem are going to take the brunt of the damage. Yeah.
So if we make these declarations of climate emergency, what are we hoping will follow such a declaration?
Legislative action.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an easy answer. I mean, that we all need to take personal responsibility for our lifestyles. We need to reduce, our carbon footprints as much as possible. But the problem is at a scale right now where the only real fundamental solution is going to come from large-scale policy action. And that's only going to happen when this is a priority for voters and then a priority for legislators.
It's kind of scary, too, when you think about how long legislation can take, right, to be implemented. Yeah.
Well, we've also seen, though, how quickly things can happen.
If you've got the force behind you, right, yeah.
Coronavirus.
Oh, yeah.
We have stopped the presses. We have said, hold everything. We are now blocking borders. We are segregating communities. We are doing everything we can, right? And we should be doing. We don't want it to spread. We need that kind of response around this climate emergency.
Yeah. And I think you're right, and I think that's where the faith community comes in, is that we can help empower our folks to do something. When we watch the ice melt, we're looking at it from afar and say, okay, we don't have ice in our backyard. And then people feel powerless. On the other hand, we have to start doing something now. And one of the things that we do at Wacoit is to tell people even a little thing is better than doing nothing, because a lot of little things put together make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the shift we're seeing with the faith communities, is empowering people to respond appropriately.
So what you're seeing then in your congregation is these conversations about what we can do locally?
Yes, not only conversations, but living mm-hmm. into it. on a local level, what really struck me a couple of years ago, someone at the Bacoit Bay Reserve said in passing, there's a dead zone in the Childs River. Mm-hmm. That is in Bacoit. What are we doing about that? So we got rid of all our single-use plastics in our church. We now have a water bubbler. We did a very daring thing by getting rid of styrofoam coffee cups years ago. I thought there was going to be a revolt in the church, but we use mugs now. We're getting solar panels on our roof. That will happen. And then another thing that is just amazing what we've done is we started a bulk buying club. The goal there is zero plastic. You go into one of these grocery stores, you can't put groceries in a plastic bag, but there's plastic everywhere. So now we have 30 families. We buy in bulk the big 50-pound bags of flour, and we bag it in paper bags with the goal of you only take your trash out once every 3 months.
Go ahead.
So I think that's right, that we have to educate people, wake people up enough to where they begin to take some personal responsibility. And so now this is where I'm going to get in trouble. Because people always say that I'm mixing politics and religion. But what David is saying is right. This is so huge. None of us individually can do much about it, right? We need an administration. We need a government that doesn't deny the science, that embraces what we all see with our own eyes and we hear with our own ears. We can start with that, and then we could have the kind of reaction in this country around climate, the climate crisis, the climate emergency, as we see around coronavirus. I'll get off my
President Trump has stated that he does not believe in climate change, and many of his supporters include evangelical Christians. What are your thoughts as to why evangelical Christians don't see climate change in the way other faith communities do? And that's a question for one of you rather than David. I don't know.
So I'll hand that off to one of you because that's a distinction that I have more trouble with. I will say, however, when I said that faith leaders came out of the woodwork to join the Faith Science Alliance, the community we had the most trouble reaching was evangelical Christians. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to do a broad answer. Theologically, the evangelicals who are more far to the right say that God is in charge, which is absolutely true, but then they don't take any responsibility. I believe that we are co-creators, co-caretakers of the earth with God. So there's a fundamental difference how we see things. Mm-hmm. So instead of waiting for the grand puppeteer in the sky to fix things, I think God looks to us and say, you know, get to work. If you love where you live, if you love creation, if you love me, get to work. And that's where I come from.
So for me, it goes back to that centuries-long debate, creationism versus evolution, right? And so we have had evangelicals, and I came through a sort of evangelical background as a young man growing up in the South that wanted to deny the science, right? And so I think we see some of that existing today in form of the evangelicals who want to deny the science, and it's all about God created the earth in 7 days, and God's going to take care of the earth, and we just have to have faith, right? And at the same time, we are watching what God created being destroyed, not by God, but by us. So that's the distinction for me. Yeah.
And I think we're seeing, I do want to say that we are seeing a shift. There are a number of younger evangelicals who the climate crisis is foremost important to them. I know that there's a number of evangelical leaning faith communities here on Cape Cod that are looking at the climate crisis. So it's really a spectrum.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. We'd love to hear from you. Has your faith community influenced your views about climate change? And what are some of the ways you're taking action to address climate change? 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the growing connection between faith communities and climate action. In studio with us is David McGlinchey, Chief of External Affairs at the Woods Hole Research Center, Reverend Bill Mebben at the St. Barnabas Episcopalian Church in Falmouth, and Reverend Nell Fields from the Coit Congregational Church. 866-999-4626. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It can be really difficult to talk about climate change, particularly with those who have differing views. Should we have these conversations? And if so, what's your advice on how to keep them constructive in your own faith community, David? How do you do that?
So I think especially when you're within a faith community, I mean, we face this problem in all walks of life. How do you bring up climate change and, you know, audiences haven't been thinking about it as much as we've been thinking about it? But in the faith community, there's a really, in my opinion, obvious way to go after it, which is the poorest and most vulnerable and the impact there. Because especially, you know, I'm Christian, and the message from Jesus is, you know, look after the poorest, look after the most vulnerable, you know, give your time, give your efforts to helping those communities. And if you can explain how climate change is going to impact, you know, communities that have less capacity than we do, for example, here. That's just a common thread that can be picked up on. Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention also, you know, we were talking about churches here on Cape Cod. I attend Cape Cod Church, and Reverend Ben Feldot and I have spoken about this a little bit, and they're holding an upcoming conference, the Thrive Conference, where I believe they're going to touch on environmental issues to some degree. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, being addressed in lots of different churches, lots of different houses of worship, and it's encouraging.
Yeah, and I would say you touched on a good point there about talking about communities, poor communities, and not necessarily here. We're talking around the globe, because isn't that what churches do? We hear about churches all the time going to different places to help people with particular problems they might have, right? So that, I would think, does that seem to resonate with the parishioners you have that are in the field of, well, I don't know if it's real?
I think on some level it does, but for the most part, people are responding because we have this message, love where you live, and if we start talking about, gee, for the past 10 years we've been dumping chemicals on our lawn, that has to impact something. And so I think people are starting to take responsibility for who they are and how they're contributing and how they are responding. I have seen that's more of an immediate response than looking at the long view, which mm-hmm. is very important. It is going to hurt the poor, but for right now, I can get people to move by looking at where they're living.
Right. Go ahead.
So I am very grateful that the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, the Most Reverend Michael Bruce Curry, has created a whole department and staff in the Episcopal Church worldwide to begin to educate people and begin to make people aware of the danger of the crisis. I'm grateful that here in the Diocese of Massachusetts, the Episcopal Diocese of Massachusetts, our bishop, Right Reverend Alan Gates, is a part of the Faith and Science Alliance, and I'm grateful that there's the Faith Communities Environmental Network here on the Cape that is a multi-faith or at least ecumenical group that is also doing work right here on the Cape, educating, advocating. So when that happens, people began to respond. People sitting in the pews began to respond. We've got to have preachers start to preach about it. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a natural, normal part of what they hear on Sunday mornings. And it's not a one-off. It's not just on Earth Day.
Right.
We're going to hear about creation, right? We're going to hear about it regularly. And I'm glad that this Sunday at St. Barnabas, we're going to have David McGlinchey preaching at the 8 o'clock service and the 10 o'clock service, and then holding a question and answer conversation following over lunch. And it's open to the public. Anyone's welcome to attend.
I'm excited and nervous.
You'll do great. Let's talk to Angela, who's calling from East Falmouth. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. I had a question for Nell and Reverend Will. As a person of faith, can you provide some suggestions on how to reconcile feeling overwhelmed by the challenge of climate change and being just one person, yet hopeful about what we can do for the future?
Good question. Thanks for that.
Well, I always say that I'm quoting a Chinese philosopher that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and do what you can. You know, certainly, you know, get involved in local politics, but just, you know, do what you can. If it's being volunteering at the Wacoit Bay Reserve, picking up trash. I'm really into picking up trash. If you're part of a bulk buying club, if you belong to a faith community where they're still using paper cups or still bringing in the single-use plastic, I mean, I think there's a lot of little things that you can do and start to feel empowered and then start, you know, building that and going to the bigger things.
Mm-hmm. Angela, I would say being a devotee of Martin Luther King Jr., I'll sort of echo the Chinese wisdom that Nell was providing. You know, Dr. King said something like, you know, faith is being willing to take the first step when you can't see the whole staircase, right? Mm-hmm. And that is the role of faith communities, is to encourage our sisters and brothers, to help them to hold on to their faith, to attach themselves to their faith traditions, whatever it might be, and recognize that there's one God who created us all, and it's our duty and responsibility to care for this creation that God has given us, and we have to be good stewards of this creation.
David. I just add that I think it is easy to get overwhelmed, and it's probably especially true in a community like ours that is, I think, especially scientifically literate. We have, you know, obviously science interwoven throughout this entire, this whole town. But the difference, you know, there are some climate change impacts that are coming. We're seeing them now. We're experiencing them now. And the ones that are coming in the immediate coming decades are somewhat baked into the system. But if we look out beyond 30 years, there is a real split between what happens if we take action and what happens if we don't. Mm-hmm. So we're going to feel impacts, but there is still, you know, a path, a divergence in path that's within our control.
Yeah. Let's talk to Roseanne, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Good morning, Roseanne.
Good morning, Mindy. It is so good to hear this conversation. A few things. Number one, I am a member of a UU congregation on the Cape. There are several of us. And our parent organization established a program called Green Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Very, very rigorous application process. And we are a Green Sanctuary congregation. And we do a lot to mitigate against climate change and have a softer footprint. My congregation is also a member of the Faith Communities mm-hmm. Environmental Network, which was mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And we are part of the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative. We are kind of an affiliate. And we have, over the past few years, established a very strong connection with the Woods Hole Research Center. Phil Duffy has been very, very involved. And we've done a number of faith and science programs. So I think that the connection between faith communities and the scientific community is getting much, much stronger, and that's critical.
Mm-hmm. Roseanne, thank you. Thanks for calling. And I guess the Faith Communities Environmental Network is listening this morning because we also have Brian McKirk on the phone, and he is the co-chair. Good morning, Brian.
And hi, how are you?
And we should also say that you are the reverend at the Episcopal Church in Chatham, right?
That is correct.
All right. And you're calling because you want to echo some of the stuff we're already hearing, I'm sure, right?
Yes, I would like to
go ahead.
Echo your prior caller. I just wanted to elaborate a little bit about the Faith Communities Environmental Network. We're just under 4 years old, and we are comprised of 30 different faith communities on the Cape and Islands. It's an interfaith organization, and really our mission is education, advocacy, and sharing best practices for both our houses of worship and for our parishioners and our community. Basically, we do have a connection, as was previously stated, with the Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative, which has just issued a climate emergency initiative to all the towns, and we have a seat on that board. So we're working collaboratively with other sectors of Cape Cod life. One of the central things we do is we sponsor a faith science forum, and we did it this past October here in Chatham, and it drew about 340 people from all walks of Cape Cod life, and it was entitled Taking Action. And the reason I bring it up is I personally don't see a difference. Well, there's a difference. I don't see that faith and science are antithetical. I think they're two different ways of understanding and experiencing and encountering our world, and they work together in different complementary ways. But our faith science forum it was entitled Taking Action, and we had moderator Dan Wolf from Cape Cod Air. Phil Duffy gave an address from Woods Hole, as did Mary Evelyn Tucker from the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology. And we also had panelists from the Center for Coastal Studies, Rich Delaney, from the Association for the Preservation of Cape Cod, the Sierra Club 350, Nauset High School. And basically, the idea I'm trying to convey is that we're all in this together. Right. It's a relational, collaborative effort here on the Cape. And we see this as a moral issue. Of course, it's a scientific, technological, public policy issue, but it boils down to morality because it involves principles. Principles that say it's wrong to waste and pollute our earth. It's wrong to treat our environment, nature, plants, animals, our air and sky, not as equal members in the community of life. And I think it's a call for everyone to a life that's changed, that encompasses frugality and simplicity of life and self-sacrifice, the common good, respect and reverence. So I think we're getting into the moral part of this. So,
yeah. Brian, you mentioned the petition articles, and there was an article in this morning's Cape Cod Times that Doug Frazier wrote about that. And 13 towns already have received these signed petitions. What are we hoping is going to come out of these climate change emergency petitions at town meeting?
That all the towns will take climate change, see it as an emergency, and to be acted on immediately. And there's not any time to be wasted in this. So that will enter their consciousness when decisions are made about how to build things, how to run transportation in a town, et cetera, because the next decade is really crucial. And it is an emergency, and we don't want it to become a catastrophe.
Yeah. Brian, thanks so much for calling in and sharing all that with us. I really appreciate it. And as Brian said, on the Cape, Coast, and Islands, we are faced with some difficult decisions and because of climate change. One example is choices about when and where we'll need to retreat from rising sea level and coastal erosion. Should municipalities raise roadways to reach private homes or code certain areas back to nature? What happens to private property that's left abandoned? While we may be in agreement about the need for climate action, we might not be in agreement about what action to take, right? So what are your thoughts on how communities can best work through these difficult scenarios? David, I'm going to turn to you for that one.
So, we can look forward. We can use climate modeling to look at how this is going to play out. We can look at what sea level rise is going to do. We can look at precipitation, heat, and we can make infrastructure decisions based on that science. But none of that is relevant unless we aggressively reduce emissions and, in fact, work with, to sequester carbon out of the atmosphere using forests and soils, because it's just going to get a lot worse. And it's not going to get worse. It's going to become it's not only going to get worse. It's going to become unstable. We're not shifting to a kind of a different stage, a new climate. We're entering a period of instability, and it's really hard to build infrastructure if you don't know what the future is going to look like. So, we can use climate modeling to make those building decisions and those zoning decisions and those retreat decisions, but none of it is important. None of it is useful unless we dramatically and aggressively reduce emissions.
Yeah. That kind of goes back to what you were saying about everybody kind of doing their part, right? And then, and what Bill, you're saying, and then we need everybody. We need those up right on the top, and we need from the grassroots, right?
Because I think when people feel like they can do something, they're empowered, and then they can start looking at the bigger issues. But I think people can't get to these big, overwhelming issues until they start taking care of the little things first. And it when I listened to your answer, David, that infrastructure thing is going to be very, very tough, because does it benefit the people who are wealthy and have places on the shore? Does it benefit the poor people who've maybe had to leave those areas, not necessarily in Cape Cod, but in other areas? And, you know, that gets at the heart of some very tough moral issues for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel confident that in each of our faiths, whether we are Jewish or Christian or Muslim, Unitarian, Baha'i, whatever, we probably all say prayers thanking our Creator for the gifts of water, the sun, and the wind. And it has always baffled me for decades now why we don't take these gifts that God has given us, wind, water, sun, and use these God-given gifts to provide what we want and need in terms of energy, right? Why do we have to destroy the earth? Why do we have to pollute the waters and pollute the air? Why don't we use them? They're there for us to use. And they don't cost us anything. God says, here's a gift. Here they are. Use these things.
All right, well, we're going to take a break on that note. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the growing connection between faith communities and climate action. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have thoughts for this morning's conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is David McGlinchey, Chief of External Affairs at the Woods Hole Research Center, Reverend Bill Mebben at St. Barnabas Episcopalian Church in Falmouth, and Reverend Nell Fields from the Waquit Congregational Church. We talked a little bit about how this was going to impact. Now, obviously, this is global. This is not just local. We're going to see millions of people who are displaced by climate change around the world. At the same time, many countries, including the U.S., are closing the doors to refugees and immigrants. What are your thoughts on our responsibility for those outside of our borders? Anybody?
Again, I'll go to our Abrahamic faiths, at least, and they all say in one way or another, welcome the stranger. Remember, you were once strangers in a foreign land, and remember how you were treated. So I believe it begins there. Mm-hmm. We talk about being part of a global community, yet we want to erect barriers within the global community to keep people out of certain parts of that global community. I mean, that just seems like a contradiction to me.
Well, I agree. We have a responsibility to help one another. And climate refugees, that's already happening. And it really is everywhere, in some extent on our southern border. But I look at India, for an example, where there's large communities without water. You know, we're talking about basic human needs. And absolutely, that's the big picture, is that we absolutely have to help one another.
I agree with that. I think we have a moral responsibility for climate refugees, but we have an additional responsibility because it was our emissions that caused this problem. Mm. This isn't a kind of a responsibility in the abstract.
Preach, brother. Preach.
We're the ones who did this. And so to cause these problems, to set these events in motion, and then to close our borders to the very people who are feeling these impacts is just It's a complete immoral. Abdication yeah. of any principles.
And to what you said, a lot of people don't think it's that we were responsible. Right. So I think that we have to make that connection because we're part of the 1% or the 2%. We have to say, I may not have done something personally, but I'm part of that 1% and I need to fix it.
Right. Let's talk to Susan calling from Yarmouthport. Good morning, Susan.
Hello, Mindy. I'm the other co-chair for the Faith Communities Environmental Network. And speaking to your issue of how to deal with these difficult challenges, what I'm finding in my church at the Unitarian Church of Barnstable is that there's an inner shift that also has to take place as we do these ripples of impacting for the good. So like Nell is saying, we can do individual action. And as the others are saying, then we take local town action, like today with the climate emergencies. But I think we also, this coming Earth Day, need to go deeply inner and realize that we're being called to a shift of consciousness from being consumers and just caring about my individual property value and whether I can get across the bridge or not. And we need to open up to the fact that this is going to require sacrifice and deep change about our economic realities. So unless we have that resilience that faith can bring us, whatever level of faith we have or spirituality we have, unless we develop that resilience, it's difficult to like consciously move into sacrifice. But I think that's what these decisions are going to require that we'll face town by town.
Yeah, Susan, thanks for that. I'm having nodding heads around the table. Go ahead, Bill.
I am so grateful for that comment, Susan. Thank you so very much. And we at St. Barnabas, we have decided that 2020 is going to be the year when we commit to awakening the human spirit to rise up and act now. You were so right. Tomorrow is the beginning of Lent in our tradition, in our Christian tradition. And I'm calling upon our community of St. Barnabas and people throughout the area to spend this time going deep, as you were saying, Susan, going deeper to find a way to awaken that spirit that is in them to then rise up and to take action to address, yes, climate change, but so many of the other ills and immoralities that we see in God's world today. But so thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
I really appreciate your comment, Susan. I would just push back on one aspect of that, which is the idea that these large-scale shifts will require societal or economic sacrifice. Because what we've seen played out in the real world is that when you put smart climate policies in place, whether it be a price on carbon or the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative here in New England, there's actually an economic boost. So yes, I think it's important and helpful that we look within ourselves, that we think about ways that we need to sacrifice for the good of others. But if we're talking about large-scale shifts, that there is a narrative out there that says it's going to cause economic harm and we just have to suffer through that. And some people don't want to suffer through that. But the lived experience is that that's not necessarily the case.
Right. Let's talk to Stephanie, who's calling from Oak Bluffs. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, I'm very glad you have this program, and I suggest that all the local newspapers have a section, a page, where we can write in and tell what we're doing, so that might encourage each other. And then I would encourage the Steamship Authority, because I live on an island, to encourage people who get off the boat here to travel in alternate days so we don't have long lines of traffic and exhaust. Mm.
Stephanie, you know what? Letters to the editor are always a good thing, and you could certainly start there. But yeah, thanks for that suggestion. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thanks. And John is calling from Barnstable. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning, Mindy. And I want to thank all of your guests for bringing this important, the most important issue to light with their congregations. And it's for food for thought. And there's a lot of heavy lifting we've all got to do, both in our personal lives and our spiritual lives. But I think one thing that I haven't heard in the conversation yet is the importance of the vote. Mm-hmm. We have elections coming up this year, and really the biggest lifting has to be done by governments, and it's got to be done in a way where informed people that have faith in science are put in charge of making these decisions that are going to govern, you know, not only the outcome in 50 years here, but our kids, our grandkids' futures. You know, we are the first generations that are feeling the effects of climate change, but we're also the last that have a chance to do anything about it. So I just wondered about that.
John, thanks. That's a really good point. And I think, Reverend Mevin, you did bring up the point about we need to look at who we're voting for, because administration policy certainly sets. And David, I imagine for you and other scientists, this has been a very frustrating time as science has been kind of undermined, right? I mean, very difficult.
It's been a challenge to have the message coming from Washington that this is, you know, not a problem, or, you know, we see wildfires in California that are so clearly tied to, you know, increased heat, increased drought, and to hear the message coming that, you know, that's not tied to climate change. It is frustrating.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there are plenty of people in Washington who do take it seriously, but I also very much agree with the caller that, you know, when voting, taking into consideration a candidate's climate change stance and opinion on science is important.
Let's talk about youth for a second. How are youth and young adults engaged about climate action? And do they come at this issue from a different direction than those who are, say, maybe over 40? Anybody have thoughts on that? I have thoughts on that. Because I think in the young people I talk to, we talk about a lot of doom and gloom, and you would think, geez, we keep saying, oh, this is your problem. This is the next generation, right? And they look at us going, you people aren't doing enough to help our generation. But I feel like in the young people that I talk to, they are not looking at this as doom and gloom. They are looking at it as, hey, we're going to tackle this. They're positive, they're hopeful, and they're full of ideas. Is anybody else seeing that?
I do see that, and I think they're positive and hopeful about a lot of things.
True.
Which absolutely gives me hope. When we start making a change in our congregation in response to the climate emergency, the youth are looking at us like, that took this long? You're still getting pushback on this? What took us so long to get the solar panels on? So they have a totally different attitude, I think, than we do. And it just gives me so much hope.
Yeah. Anybody else? Go ahead.
No, I agree. I mean, it's encouraging. It's invigorating. And there's when you look under a certain age, there is no controversy. There is no debate. There's just kind of a get on with it, adults.
Yeah.
I think Greta Thunberg.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Amen. Yes.
Her message is so resonant because it's so simple. And I heard her speak, and when I was there, her message was very essentially, what's wrong with you adults?
Yeah.
Like, get
right.
it together. You know, I can understand this. I'm a teenager.
And then we shouldn't have leaders of powerful countries then making fun of her and trying to dismiss her, right? I mean, back to the caller asking about political engagement and involvement. Yes, we've got to have a person running the EPA who believed in the reason the EPA was created in the first place and is not, and then has not spent their career trying to undo all the good work that's been done by the EPA. I mean, this is real. And people have an opportunity to exercise their vote. I will not tell you for whom to vote, not publicly, but I'd be happy to tell you privately. There, we have to listen to the people who are committed to doing the work that needs to be done to save this planet with God's help.
So what role can or should Sunday schools, Hebrew schools, religious youth groups play in educating children who are growing up with faith about climate change?
I think it's about truth-telling. It's about our telling the youth the truth that we are where we are because the previous generations, including myself, didn't respond appropriately. We didn't take care. We weren't good stewards. I think that's important. But the second thing is to keep the youth in the conversation. We're very lucky here on the Cape that we have a number of faith and science initiatives. Where are the youth? They need to be part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Because we're going to pass the mantle very soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, we at St. Barnabas have a program for our children and youth called Love First, and it's all about loving yourself, loving God, and loving your neighbor. If we begin with love, and true love for our neighbor, true love for God, then if we're teaching our children that, then they will take the actions necessary to make sure that the some of the problems that we've been talking about are not only addressed, but eliminated, right?
Yeah. So the Faith Science Alliance, just building off those two, it's less than a year old. So these programs are building, these ideas are building. But one of the founding ideas was to deliver science and deliver climate science to religious schools. The Catholic Church has a big network of mm-hmm. schools mm-hmm. within the state. Audiences like that who are really receptive. They want this science, and the idea is to figure out a way to deliver it. And we've been working initially with a school called the Alhambra Academy, which is an Islamic school here in the state. Their students came to the Woods Hole Research Center last year. They're going to come back again this year. But we found that if we are willing to provide it, if we can create a channel where we deliver this climate science to these teachers, they're ready.
Now, you said something earlier I thought was interesting, and that is delivering a positive message. People respond better to a positive message than you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that, right? So I guess that's sort of one of the ways, at least in your congregation, you're framing it, trying to spin this into a positive message so people will respond.
Right. One of the callers earlier talked about that shift, and we hear so much negative news. We're getting so much negative thoughts and words. I try to put everything in a positive way. So instead of using the stick, using the carrot, because that's what, if we get the science from the head to the heart, then we start making changes. And so one of the things I always say, love where you live. We can look at nip bottles, the litter on the ground. Oh, I love where I live. I'm going to pick up that litter. I love where I live. We're going to start not using chemicals on our lawn so we kill the Child's River, which is right next door. And people respond to that.
Yeah. David, I'm just thinking, we've got a lot of decisions to make. And we talked about we might be in agreement that climate change is happening, but how we deal with it and these decisions, coming to consensus, especially politically, is so difficult now. How do we, the conversation, we just talked about making fun of Greta. I mean, all of these things, how do we, as a community, talk about this civilly, I guess.
Yeah. So I'm actually, there's easy ways to criticize the worst actors in this, the people who would publicly attack a teenager on Twitter, for example. But I actually would just for the moment shift the focus back to the environmental community, because we tend to have a scolding attitude. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Reverend, you mentioned earlier that you're late to this, right? Or I don't think you are, but you described it that way. There's a typical environmental reaction of, somebody comes into the movement, joins the cause, and instead of welcoming them,
Where have you been?
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. What took you so long? Yeah. And that's not the approach. Because, first of all, not everybody lives in this bubble where we think about these scientific issues all the time. And as people do become aware of the scope, of the scale, of the urgency and immediacy of the problem, that's a great thing. That's a wonderful thing. So let's welcome people in. And I'm not suggesting that's the main problem. I think there are people who are actively opposing
it. It's a good place to start, though, right?
Yeah.
All right, David McClinchy will speak about the ecological and moral emergency of climate change at St. Barnabas on Sunday, March 1st at 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. Services. Public is invited to attend. We'll post more information at our website, capeandislands.org. David McClinchy, Chief of External Affairs at the Woods Hole Research Center, Reverend Bill Mebbin from St. Barnabas Episcopal Church in Falmouth, and Reverend Nell Fields from the Wacoit Congregational Church. Thank you all, and thank you for all the work you're doing here. It's so important. Really appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you so much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.